Hey, how's it going? Assalamu alaikum, peace. It's Imran here. Hope you're all well. So, off the back of the last episode where you heard from Salma Khan talk about divorce coaching, and if you haven't listened to it, please do. It was a really, really engaging discussion. Today, you're going to hear from another inspirational figure from the community called Nav Mirza. Now, back in 2013, Nav went through what can only be described as a seriously acrimonious divorce. It resulted in him losing access to his son through no fault of his own, and he spent many, many years trying to regain access. At one point, he lost all hope and, trigger warning, he attempted suicide. But thankfully, he came through that, and through a series of unexpected events, he was then given sole access to his son. Now, you'd think that's the end of the story and that's the happy ending, but actually, it's only the beginning. Because what Nav then experienced was the challenge of single fatherhood. And he simply wasn't prepared for it. He wasn't prepared for the isolation. He wasn't prepared for the lack of support. Whenever he reached out, there was no one there for him. And so again, he was left at a point of despair, unable to find work that could help him to maintain his household whilst being a single parent. He was stuck. So he decided to do something that most of us wouldn't. He decided to set up an organization, not only to help himself, but to help other fathers going through a similar experience. And that's when Dads Unlimited was born, a charity that he describes as primarily a suicide prevention charity, one which helps fathers and supports fathers through the process of family breakdown and helps them to maintain healthy relationships with their children wherever possible. Now, you might be wondering, why is a charity that is there to help fathers primarily concerned with suicide? Well, let me give you a statistic. Their research shows that 53% of the fathers that they've dealt with, and they're dealing with about 800 a year, have reported suicidal ideation. Helping fathers to maintain healthy relationships with their children saves lives. Now, you may be hearing this and thinking, well, why aren't we talking about mothers as well? The reason why we're talking about fathers specifically is because of the disparity in the support structures that are in place to enable that to happen. This is a story about love and not hate. This is a story about unity and not division. It's about everybody coming together to do the right thing. I really hope you enjoy this episode. If you do have any feedback, please do email me divorcedmuslimdad@gmail.com, or you can hit me up on Instagram at MOIAZAM. If you would like to get involved with Dads Unlimited, then I'll leave details at the end of the episode and in the show notes. So sit back and listen to season 2, episode 11, Fathers Matter.
Sometimes in our lives, we all have pain, we all have sorrow, but if we are wise, we know that there's always tomorrow. Lean on me when you're not strong.
About 3 weeks ago, you and I
was sat on the Asian Parent Network podcast. And when I heard, I'd never heard of you, of your organization before, but when I did raise my eyebrows, because Dads Unlimited, it just came across as completely countercultural. I thought that the idea that there were support groups out there specifically for fathers had kind of died with Fathers for Justice. And apologies, but Fathers for Justice is the first thing that came to mind. And I'm sure that you haven't heard, that's not the first time.
No, it's not. That.
But what's behind this organization? Where did it start?
I founded Dads Unlimited in 2017, but really there was a sort of a four-year build-up to that. 2013, happily married, and then sadly, my wife at the time and my son at the time was, I think, just turned 5 years old. And it was quite painful for me because obviously, you know, when you grow up, you want to be with your son or your children as much as possible and do all of the stuff that you wanted to do, you know, the bedtime, bath times and all that kind of stuff. But of course, like I say, it descended into a very hostile situation. And, you know, my son was then sort of spending sort of every other weekend with me, and it wasn't enough. And I was extremely sad and distraught with not being able to be with him every day.
What you've just described there in terms of the arrangement that almost automatically took place was that you were spending the minority amount of time with your son. How did that come about?
At the point of separation, my wife started a new relationship. And I think there was a lot of championing on the other side of, you know, oh, actually, you know, he should be with you. He should be with you. And so it was natural that the time with my son was deteriorating. And it became very difficult for me because I couldn't fight that. And my ex-wife started coming up with a mendacious sort of a narrative about me. And it just descended into a farce. And it became very, very challenging for me. It was her that moved out and found a new place. So I was left in the family home. And like I said, you know, I'd go to work, come home, house was empty. It was, you know, I was deafened by my son's silence. Mm. And I'd break down and cry so much because I was just missing him immensely. But the hostility grew because when I was collecting him from the appointed pickup place and dropping him off, you know, the new boyfriend was there and he was starting the usual arguments. And I was like, God, my son is actually going into a really hostile place. And of course, my red flags were just flying for me saying, this isn't right. And then my son would say things that were happening to him at mum's house. And so I took disclosures, let's call them, to mum and just said, look, this is what he's saying, blah, blah, blah. It ended up with her saying, oh, you're lying, you're making this stuff up, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You shouldn't see him, which then made me very, very upset and very distraught. And of course, then you have no option but to go down that legal road, which I really, not that I didn't want to do, but I knew as soon as you go down that path, it just makes everything a lot more challenging because everything was so all-consuming. I didn't perform at work. I wasn't delivering what I needed to do at work, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, it ended up sort of 9 months later. Not that I lost my job, but I just had to leave because I just couldn't handle it. There was too much worry. But also I was really worried about my son. Like, I knew the environment he was in was not safe. I knew that. And so I started that contacting the school, contacting social services, contacting the police, just asking people to have a look and assure me that his safety was okay and that he was not at risk.
What you're describing is the opposite of what I experienced, right? Mm. So I had one of those amicable arrangements and, you know, communication was good, etc. But even then, I noticed kind of the primacy of the mother when it came to institutions. Right. So, mm-hmm. you know, when it came to school, all communication was naturally filtered through the mother. Mm. Right. Which I had no problem with, except for when those times when I needed to kind of get in touch and find something out. And they'd say, well, you're not listed on our system. Right. Yeah. And And I'd be like, well, can you list me on your system? Well, we're going to have to get permission to do that. And that just struck me as a little bit odd. So I'm thinking, when you're going to all of these institutions, and I would have assumed that if somebody's coming along and saying something potentially is harmful to the child, that they would immediately take it seriously. Did they?
You're not going to be surprised by my answer. No, I was pretty much ignored, actually. The school did, and to their credit, were a lot more cooperative in the sense that the family liaison officer at the time, you know, would often contact me and say, look, your son is distraught. He's at school. He's crying. I've been holding him. He just wants to see you. How can we help? And I thought that was quite unbelievable. But that didn't last. You know, in the end, they kind of not stopped. I don't say they deliberately stopped talking to me, but the communication evaporated fairly quickly as soon as sort of legal proceedings had started. Because I'm guessing just, you know, most organisations go, oh, let's just step away now. It's all gone legal. Mm. So that's how it was going. And of course, I wasn't getting any correspondence from anyone. The police, social services, no. It was just the end. And of course, I wasn't seeing, so I wasn't knowing how he was. And I just got worse and worse and worse. And I remember nearer the end, 2013, once I'd walked out of my job, lost, you know, kind of like said goodbye to a good salary, went back onto benefits, and still didn't know what was going on with my son. You know, it was extremely challenging until we got to the point where suicide was a very, very real option for me, because I was unable to champion or articulate or even raise awareness of my son's voice. It was as if not only had I lost agency, but my son wasn't getting any agency either.
You're in a position where you were depleted of energy anyway when these things happen, and the only thing really keeping you moving forwards is to ensure your son's well, and you know he's not in danger, but you don't seem to be able to impact that at all. And essentially, I guess you're saying you're left in a hopeless position.
Yes, and I think it's the hopelessness which I think is the worst place to be. There's a more existential issue here around, you know, we've got to look at a society of how we have allowed people to get to a point of hopelessness through what is actually and should be an amicable separation. People are allowed to separate. Children are allowed to live in two different houses. But if you remove agency from one of the parents because you're not taking seriously, then you've got a real problem in society, haven't you? You know, we've got great safeguarding protocols in this country, and you contact those people to help you understand if there are safeguarding issues or if, you know, there are protection issues to do with your children. But, you know, I remember being in a meeting with quite a lot of social workers and very child focused professionals saying, who protects our children from the people who are paid to protect our children? You know, and that's kind of like where I was. I was like, well, hold on, what's going on here? The very people who are meant to be protecting my son are not communicating, and who's protecting him against you?
Yeah.
But in the end, you know, moving forward, eventually got to court, had a 50-50 kind of shared care arrangement was put in place. Son was back in my life half the time. Everything was good. Until another 3 months later, my son was then disclosing to me about, again, the exact same issues of harm that were happening at mum's house. So again, I had to go down that road of contacting social services, da 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 da. And then, fortunately, social services did intervene and said, okay, well, let's have a look into this because, you know, let's see what's going on. But then I found an incredibly biased social worker come to see me who basically behaved, and I think in an atrocious way. And I'll never forget what he said to me. He just said, if you don't do as I tell you, I will make your life hell.
What?
And I thought to myself, my God. And I was obviously beginning to suffer with extremely poor mental health. And I started picking up, I'm sure, you know, some post-traumatic stress disorder feelings as well, because that frightened to the core. I was then became frightened of leaving the house. I became frightened of the doorbell going in case it was someone else. I was frightened of like the brown envelope coming through the door. And it was just horrible. Even though my son was coming back and forth, I had this social services investigation with a social worker who I just was not impartial, just was simply lacking any ability to be curious. It was like he had made his mind up. But this went on for quite a while. I was stopped from seeing him again. I had regular police visits saying, you're coaching your son. If you don't stop making these disclosures, or you, if you don't stop making up these stories, we're going to arrest you for perverting the course of justice. Another social worker was brought in, and in there, a newer one, and he was exactly the same. This time, my dad was sitting with me through those social worker meetings because I was just terrified of these people. And this just went on and on. And again, they stopped me seeing my son again because they said I was making up stories. And that led to, you know, another suicide attempt because I was broken. I was just functionally, mentally, physically broken. And I just thought, I can't do this anymore. I just can't do it. And I had a solicitor at the time who, lovely, lovely person. And, you know, she was fantastic in trying to help me. But even she was saying to me, I just don't know why they're just not taking this as seriously as you are saying. You know, all they had to do was do a full investigation, come back and say, nothing's wrong. What I thought I had was a biased investigation. They said, nothing's wrong. And I didn't believe it. Eventually, the old court order was put back in place. And then he was back in my life. But I still thought, do you know what? I just got to keep my mouth shut. And as long as he's with me, for half the time, I can keep him safe. And as my lawyer said, sadly, the system doesn't operate until harm is done. It doesn't prevent harm. It actually goes the other way around. Once harm is done, then it kicks into action. And I thought that was awful. But he was in my life, and 50% of the time I thought, right, I'll keep you safe, and then I will record and journalize everything you're telling me. I was battered, bruised, hadn't got a job. We were living, you know, on 70-odd quid a week from Job Seeker's Allowance. My son, I had enough money for my son to eat. I wasn't really eating because we just didn't have any money. End of January, another social worker turned up at the door and said, oh, are you so-and-so? Yeah, I am. Just want to let you know, we've had a report of an issue at Mother's house. And I've re-looked at all of your files, the letters that you had sent in, the safeguarding concerns you had raised. To cut a long story short, for 18 months, you've been right. Your son has been harmed. And we advise now that you go to the school, collect him, and we would support a transfer of residence from mum to you, and that your son should now live with you permanently under a child arrangement order.
So a total vindication of,
yes,
of what you'd been saying, and actually a confirmation that essentially only until the harm has been proven in their eyes that they're able to take action. So how did you feel at that point? Was it bittersweet?
I was in shock. I remember my cousin was there because I kind of like fell over because I honestly thought I was going to be accused of something else. But no, it was my cousin just said, look, you need to repeat all this again because he is not getting this. And then when it finally sunk in, I thought, right, I'll go and get him. So then went to school, got him. Very next day, went to court, got a court order, an emergency court order. And cut a long story short, within 6-7 weeks, through a couple of court hearings, transfer residence, and then he was all mine. And then started the next really important journey, which was, right, now I'm a single father. And I've got all this trauma I've got to deal with as well. And I've got to get him to school, blah, blah, blah. And so then started the single dad journey. And then I suddenly realised, wow, that single dad journey is really tough. Like, I was dropping him off at school, picking him up from school. No one talks to you at the school gates. No one interacts. All my friends are working. I have no social life. And my entire interaction was between me and my 6-year-old son, which was, however amazing it was, I was realizing this is really lonely. There's no support for single fathers out there.
Were you socially ostracized at all? Did rumors spread?
No, that, there was no rumors. There was no social ostracism. And there was nothing. It was just, I was unable to meet other people because I've got full-time caring responsibilities.
Yeah.
So son comes first. Yeah. I can't go out at night because there's no one around to babysit. And actually, he didn't want me out. My son was at the time was a little bit afraid. He had a bit of some counseling, some support and this, that and the other. But he didn't want me going out, you know, at all. And so it was just me and him until my parents eventually moved back from London down to where I live at the moment. And then I said, right, great. And then they stepped up and he was spending, you know, sort of a couple of nights over the weekend there with him. So he built a lovely relationship with my parents. I was then having a few hours. I could just go and see my mates quickly. And so things started shifting. And then I thought to myself, well, this is 2015, 2016, got to early 2017. And I thought, I can't be alone. You know, my brain is going dead. But I've got to do something. Couldn't get a job. I remember the job centre person saying to me, you know, we can't find a job for you because you've got XYZ qualifications and experience. Can't find a job that's going to allow you to do the school pickups and drop-offs.
Mm.
I even contacted childminders. They all said, I'm really sorry, we don't actually do any work for single fathers. I then, a very good friend of mine said, oh, go and get an au pair, live an au pair and get back to your career.
Sorry, hang on now. They said they don't
work with single
fathers.
Yeah. This is 2017. They just didn't. And I didn't question it. I just thought, okay, fair enough, just another barrier. Contacted an au pair agency. She goes, we don't place au pairs with single fathers. And I was like, God, this is really bad. And I remember saying to the job centre, I was like, well, I don't know what to do. How do I get a job? How do I get out of this situation? Because I can't find a single job at my level that will allow me to do the school run in the morning and then the school run at 3 o'clock. So then they said, oh, try and get a much lower level of job. I was like, yeah, fine. Went for loads of interviews. Every single one was, I'm sorry, you're too overqualified, too overexperienced. We can't place you here. We just don't have the, we can't do that. So I was stuck. And then a very good friend of mine just said, you know, Nav, when you set up a Facebook page, because you can't be alone. There's got to be other guys like you in the country. So 2017 was the birth of the Dads Unlimited Facebook page. And then a few guys came forward and then I was helping them. A few more months went on. And again, my mate said, well, look, you need to turn this into something. Look, you might have just stumbled upon something. September 2017, the charity was registered with the Charity Commission. Beginning of 2018, picked up my first little small piece of funding. Started putting on support group meetings in my local area for dads to come together. And then I suddenly realised, actually, there's a few of us here. We've all got stories to talk about. We've all been through very similar experiences. We've all been not believed by statutory agencies when it comes to fathers raising awareness of the risks their children may be in. And I thought, right, this really fired me up. And I thought, right, I'm going to do something about this. And it would have been very easy. My solicitor said to me, it would be very easy to put in a negligence claim to my local authority for the behaviour of the social worker. Yeah. And she goes, you could probably win that. And I said, yeah, I could do. But you know what? I'm not going to do that. I'm going to turn this tragedy and make it into something else. I'm going to go and help all these guys who are going through the same problem in the country. Because actually, I think we've got a story to tell. And I think we have got to do something that, as I said right earlier, we have to look at society to say, how does a man, a father, a loving, safe, law-abiding citizen, get to the point where suicide is an option just because they're going through separation? And that's what the charity was about. And like I say, it has accelerated since September 2017. I think we are the biggest dads charity in the UK now. We help roughly 800 men a year, and we're trying to change the way things are done. We're not campaigners, activists. I wanted to create something that supported fathers going through family breakdown, looked after their mental health, helped them with parental conflict, stroke co-parenting, fundamentally wanted to tackle the issue of the cost of family law litigation because it is extortionate, and wanted to raise awareness that family breakdown, loss of contact with children, is a trigger for suicide. And I wanted to, above all, create a community of fathers coming together to say, we want to be heard. We've been invisible for far too long, and we want to make a difference in this world and show you that the role of a father and the value we have in our children's lives needs to be equally realised at the parenting table.
So when I mentioned at the beginning that my first thought was Fathers for Justice, Just clarify why this isn't a reincarnation of Fathers for Justice.
So we are a suicide prevention charity, number one, front and center. Number two, we're identifying and raising awareness that family breakdown, loss of contact with children can lead to suicide. And the service lines I wanted to put together, so for the charity, was that I wanted a guy to come to my charity and say, you can get all of your help here. So we give them a mentoring service, one-to-one, to guide, shepherd, advise all the way through family breakdown, not legally, no legal advice, just general advice and guidance through that to keep them safe, keep them well, keep them alive. We then layer that with access to our mental health counselling service. We then layer that with access to our family court support service. I think we're the only charity that has barristers who work for us on a fixed fee scheme so that these fathers get access to professional legal representation on a fixed fee. So that therefore is none of this solicitors, £200 an hour plus VAT stuff. Actually, we will help you fill out the forms for free. We will help you get you ready, court ready for free. We'll put your bundle together. We'll get your papers together. And then we'll put you with a barrister to represent you in court. You know, there's a saying, you know, justice delayed is justice denied. Making sure these fathers get access to professional legal advice so that they're kept on the right path on a fixed fee so they're not accruing debt. And debt, we know, is one of the triggers towards suicide. They then get community activities. So we bring these guys together and we put on stuff, not your cinema sort of, you know, bowling stuff, just really good stuff that they can do with their kids together to build a community of single fathers and their kids having a great time learning stuff, but developing a community. And then the biggie that came out of this was I run these support group meetings and more of these guys were saying to us, oh, this is happening to me. This has happened to me. I think I'm being abused, blah, blah, blah. And we started raising awareness of the potential that some of these men are actually victims of domestic abuse. We were commissioned through the Ministry of Justice setting up the first male victims of domestic abuse service. So we now also look after male victims of DA as another separate service line. So we've got the whole bundle inside one charity and we operate across the whole of England and Wales. And actually, you know, because of the stuff that we do, we are now influencing how things are happening, how things should change. We don't do the campaign in activism. We just go through empirical evidence. We have clear evidence, family breakdown, loss of contact with children is a trigger towards suicide. We have clear evidence about, you know, what the mental health is of the fathers that we are working with. We have clear evidence of the levels of suicidal ideation. I can tell you right now, because of the business intelligence stuff that we have sitting behind the work that we do, 53.7% of the fathers we look after across the UK are feeling suicidal or are actively suicidal right now. That's something that's got to be taken seriously. And we've had major impact with local social services departments where we now train, advise and guide around father inclusive practice. Only a couple of weeks ago, we've worked with one county council and they're changing everything they do around family breakdown through the lens of father inclusive practice. That's an enormous change. We're raising awareness of unconscious bias. So everything that happened to me is now, like 5, 6, 7 years later, we can see the beginning of change, of society changing. And last year, because of the work we did, you know, we won the GlaxoSmithKline King's Fund Impact Awards for 2022 as one of the top 10 charities in the UK. And that's an amazing achievement to have won such a prestigious award, which now connects us into the whole GlaxoSmithKline network, King's Fund network, blah, 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 because of our impact upon suicide prevention. So, you know, in a way, I have to pinch myself with how much we've achieved and that we are changing things. Arguably, it's taking a long time. It's a worthwhile cause.
Why do you think we've reached this particular point where Dad's Unlimited is needed? I mean, it's 2023, right? Mm. And from what I'm hearing, society, in terms of its culture, if you like, and the way and our expectations, and also institutions, don't seem to be taking the role of the father as seriously as it should, right? So, how have we reached that stage?
I think there has been a failure on fathers generally to emancipate ourselves from our fathers and our role in society. I don't think we've done a very good job at saying how important we are in the raising of our children. I think we've just let it happen. I think there has been hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years where man is hunter-gatherer, providing food on the table, roof overhead, water in the house, you know. Yeah. And there's nothing wrong with that, but tides have been changing where more and more fathers go, no, I want to be hands-on. I want to be that bedtime, bath time, school run, homework. And I don't think we've been very good at advocating that. I don't think we've redefined ourselves very well. Then I think there's an issue with employers. Generally, employment does not recognise single fathers and allows them the time off they need to be single fathers if they are single fathers, or to recognise they need to be at sports days. One of the things I always say to my dads when we're helping them is, please make sure you turn up to sports day. Your kids are at primary school for roughly 6 years, six sports days. Take the time off. If you want to be a hands-on dad, it's not every, don't accept every other weekend. Just be, no, I'm an important person in my child's life. Because we as fathers have, we've got to be valued as fathers and value that we're bringing something to the parenting table. So I don't think we're doing that. The third thing, and I, again, part of the work of the charity and what we're trying to influence is, if you look at most of the caring sector, so you look at schools, look at social work, you look at CAFCAS, it is mainly staffed by women. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. But men don't choose that profession. And so therefore there's an absence of the male lens. If you look at most domestic abuse agencies, they're virtually staffed with women, and that's fine. But you've got to have another lens if you want to look at male victims of domestic abuse, because men have to be treated differently and cared for in a different way.
I guess so you're going to say the same with social care as well.
Yeah, exactly. If you look at it, and there's nothing, I'm not saying that's a problem. What I'm saying is the system isn't waking up and realizing that we need balance. And I think the key word here is balance. It's about how do we improve male role models for children who are getting to see more men and getting to realize that men are allowed to care for their children. Men do love their children. Men can cry if they don't see their children. We're told to man up, toughen up. You know, you must have heard the old, you know, you have a go for a family breakdown, and women are phenomenal at creating support networks for themselves. Us blokes are just rubbish at it. But we shouldn't be afraid at trying to say, look, I need help. I think we've got an issue with us saying help. It goes back to my point about emancipation from the previous models of our, you know, of our fathers. And we've got to get society to realize that we have a value, and we have to have that value recognized and appreciated. And then, of course, overlying all of that, you do have a major problem with unconscious bias. You know, if you've got phrases like mum knows best, you also need dad knows best. You know, we don't have these things, but slowly we need to make a shift and realize that fathers are important and value them more. And I think all these things conspire, but I do believe genuinely that things are changing. It is going to take a long time. I often think to myself, you know, the male victims of DA that we look after, we're on the same journey with that female victims had many, many, many years ago about being believed. So, you know, they had it really tough. And I think they're still on a journey, but we're like 20 years behind them. So hopefully we can begin to educate and raise awareness that actually there are women out there who abuse men as well. And there's nothing, you know, that's not a controversial thing to say, but it's a realization that this does happen. So I have a lot of hope for the future, but this is what the charity does. It doesn't do that kind of activism of, you know, stunts and that sort of stuff. No, I want people to take notice of what we do through the evidence that we have that demonstrates that we've got to change the way things happen.
It's like a grown-up approach, I guess. I mean,
hopefully,
you know, I remember, obviously everybody remembers the stunts, which, you know, I guess they're a little bit Just Stop Oil-ish, you know, in that they're there to annoy people, they're there to grab attention, as if attention, any kind of attention, positive or negative, is going to bring about change. Whereas your approach is more conciliatory. It's about bringing people along the journey. It's about realizing that it's not men against women. It's men with women working together in order to achieve a better future. And the reason I started my podcast, and that was back in about 2018. Was essentially, you know, I felt that there was a huge amount at stake, because I'm sure you kept hearing about in your circles, like, you know, the huge amount of relationship breakdown that was going on, and the fact there were children involved, and that the blokes specifically, nobody was really talking about it. And you'd always hear the same phrase. It's like, oh, we thought you guys were fine, right? Because everybody keeps the issues to themselves. You know?
I mean, you'll laugh at this, right? There is so much news around rubbish dads who don't pay child maintenance. You know, we hear this all the time. And I'm, you know, I do know that there are some rubbish dads out there who don't pay child maintenance, and they should pay child maintenance. That's not in question. I'm a single father. I have been now since 2015 with my son living with me. It's been 8 years. I haven't received a penny in child maintenance. Right? But you don't hear about rubbish mums, you don't pay child maintenance, do you?
Mm.
Balance. It's media reporting. But look, at the end of the day, I often say this. If you just imagine a tent, all I want to do, and the way DU operates, is we don't throw stones at statutory agencies and say, you're rubbish, you're rubbish, you're rubbish, you're rubbish, you're rubbish. What we say is, how can we work with you to make the system better? Can we get inside the same tent and together, through collaboration, partnership working, we can make the system better for everyone? And that, I think, is a much more cerebral approach than throwing stones.
You cited these agencies which are primarily staffed by women, which we both agree that's a great thing. It's just it just means there's one particular perspective within these organizations. And over the decades now, that has led to a particular attitude, I guess, when it comes to men's involvement in their families. And now you come along with your organization and saying, well, look, maybe things need to change a little bit. I'm just guessing maybe there's going to be people in there saying, no, men, I mean, maybe they won't say it, but maybe they'll feel that men are kind of the enemy.
Right. So in the early days of DU, I did get pushback because they just thought we were a bunch of angry dads just making noise.
Mm.
Now doors have opened for us and we are actually invited. You know, I now sit on two all-party parliamentary groups where we talk about this sort of stuff. I've delivered keynote speeches across the country, you know, at very important conferences about what we do. And that's not me pushing, that's me being invited. And I think when we are now sitting in rooms with me and my staff or my staff members who are attending these very important meetings, we're there because they want us to be there, because I think the system slowly realizing that actually intelligent discourse with a charity trying to make society better for everyone is the way forward. We are not a polarizing, myopic kind of, you must make this good for dads. You need to value fathers, but if we work together, what is there we could not achieve? And I think that dialogue, that narrative has opened doors for us. And I'm going to be honest with you, I don't really feel like we are having too much pushback. I mean, I've had some very good conversations with members of the House of Lords, for example, around what we've done. And they've even said, you know, carry on going, because actually you're on the right path. There's the establishment across the country of family hubs. You may or may not have heard. It's a government initiative. We've been asked specifically to be liaised with, so that the lens of father inclusive guidance is through us advising and supporting and helping the system change that lens. So I think the doors are well and truly open. We treat everyone with respect. We're not, like I say, we're not this campaigning activist stuff. This is just about making things better for everyone. We're at the right table with the right people having the right conversations.
You know, when I went through my divorce, and that was back in 2011, you know, we had small kids at the time. Daughter was 9, son was 7 years old. And, you know, I was speaking to my ex-wife at the time before we told the kids, and we said, look, you know, we're going to have to break it to them. And so we sat them down and we kept it simple, because that was the advice that we'd received. Like, look, you know, don't overcomplicate things for small kids. But one of the key messages that we wanted to give them was, look, you know, mummy and daddy are not going to be together, but, you know, our family, you know, will still be a family. And, you know, I'm kind of really happy that we went down that particular route, because, you know, ultimately, I think that's something worth aiming for anybody going through a healthy breakup, which is to understand that, look, you know, when children are involved, you know, this is simply an ongoing commitment for the rest of your lives,
exactly.
Right? You're going to have some connection with each other. And if you're able to basically make that distinction between you as individuals and you as a family, you know, that's really going to be, I guess, the healthiest opportunity for those kids to grow in an environment where they don't feel pulled from pillar to post. And I guess that's part of what you're trying to do with, for example, your co-parenting program.
Yeah, that's, you're 100%. Yeah, I completely agree with you. You know, the thing I'll have achieved what I have achieved when, you know, the default position for family breakdown is that the first discussion is, okay, so how do the children spend equal amount of time with both parents if it's safe to do so? That should be, I think, the default. And that we remove from the system this kind of, and it's, I don't think the system is doing this deliberately, but where parents who are separating can rise above their own narrow individualistic concerns and rise above that to the broader concerns of their children and stop looking at their children as property or chattels to be bartered and negotiated. The default should be, just like we're splitting up, that's fine. You're allowed to fall out of love with your partner. But how can we remain consistent, safe and stable so that our children benefit from this?
It's one of the most stressful things you can go through emotionally. So is it any wonder that people kind of lose their minds in the process? How do you bring people back to that sense of, you know, acting with a cool, calm head rather than...
It's really hard. I mean, we in our charity, through our mentoring service, we've got a couple of mantras. The first one is success is determined by how far you're willing to travel in terms of fairness and compromise. Hold on to that. You don't have to lower yourself to the bad behavior of someone else. Focus on your children. It will be tough. It's going to be hard. It's going to challenge you. You will lose your mind through this. But focus on the most important thing, which is maintaining your dignity and integrity. Values, our own personal core values, is what gets us through this. The other problem we have is there are too many cheerleaders in the system. When my dad split up, you get cheerleaders on both sides. You know, he's this, she's that.
Yeah.
Stop listening to that. Stop Googling what you should and shouldn't do. DU functions on this very simple notion that if you come to us, you may not like what we have to say, but we're going to keep you safe, focused, and level-headed. If your mates are saying, oh, do this, don't. You don't have to retaliate. Retaliation is a choice. Bitterness is a choice. All of these are choices. So therefore, choose to remain dignified and maintain your integrity. And it will be all right in the end, because nothing is permanent here. Everything's temporary. Your children grow up, they get older, We all know this stuff. But it's focusing them to remember that. Family breakdown seen through the eyes of a child is nothing less than a tragedy. It's the difference between what was and what will never be. And you've got to keep that in mind, parents, that if you can go, do you know what, I don't want this to damage my child. And that's going back to what I said earlier about parents rising above their individualistic concerns to the broader concerns of their children. Stop thinking about yourself, think about your children. This is hard stuff. It's behavioral change management. And that's what we try to focus on, because that's the only way you're going to get success. And that's how success crystallizes and stays consistent. This is hard work, really hard work, because the biggest problem in the family law system, in just breakdown, you're dealing with the occurrence of human emotion, which is sometimes unmanageable. But we're there as a critical friend, as a safe harbor to shipwreck souls, to say, look, it'll be all right. Just we'll help you, but stay calm.
There's a huge amount at stake with this, because ultimately we're dealing with children. Children have no choice in this matter, right? It's the adults who make the decision that impact the child's life. And if you have a society full of angry parents wrestling their kids, then these kids are going to grow up largely dysfunctionally, and then that's going to have a negative impact on society. So it's a huge issue. For anybody listening to this conversation, it's very difficult to disagree with anything that's been said here. There's nothing controversial whatsoever. This isn't any kind of manospheres type discussion. It's not fathers for justice type, you know, women are evil type discussion. It's none of that at all. It's just good common sense that fathers matter. They have a role to play. Fathers and mothers matter. And the best way is for them both to do so in a union, if that's the case, and if not, then to do so outside of a union and to prioritize the needs of those kids. And so one of the things I thought about is, like, what can an individual do in order to help somebody? Because when it comes to blokes, like you said, it's a very, very lonely journey, because although there might be friends out there who are willing to help, people really don't know how to. And so really, that I think there needs to be an increase in the number of support groups that there are out there, where people are able simply to come and to express themselves and to know that they're not alone. Is this the kind of model that you're encouraging?
Yes, absolutely. So we run our own support groups, and I'd love to grow other support groups around the country. One of the reasons we haven't yet is, obviously, as a charity, funding doesn't permit us to do that straight away. But the other is, you know, I want to make sure that support groups are led by level-headed, non-activist kind of people, because this is not about, you know, banging a drum. This is about listening to these fathers, giving them a space to talk about how they're feeling. And if they're feeling suicidal, to say, actually, that's, you're allowed to feel that way. Let's see how we can help you not feel suicidal. Let's see how we can help you feel, not feel hopeless, not feel lonely, not feel isolated. But you've got to find the right character and attitude of people to lead those support groups. And I'm sure there's thousands of them up and down the country, all being led in a really great way. But I don't want, as in DU, I don't want DU to go down that, you know, activist kind of, let's go on a march through whatever and hold placards and do that. No, I just want, number one, is to make these men feel safe and go, do you know what? We've got your back. We've got you. We'll look after you. Step one. Step two, how can we use all those stories, pick up all the information and evidence from around the country that says things have got to change? Because I do think there's a lot of value in these support groups. There's a hell of a lot of value. I want DU to be a very kind of like inclusive, diverse organisation, and it's helping everyone. Our last support group meeting was last Friday night. We had, you know, quite a few guys turn up. Every single one of them were crying, and there was lots of hugs, lots of tissues, but everyone left going, do you know what? I'm not alone. I'm in it with you guys, and we're in it with you as well. And we are shoulder to shoulder in the trenches with you to try to maintain that level of dignity and integrity to go, this is going to be tough, but we'll get you through this. And you've got people in this room who are willing, that you can lean on, because loneliness is, you know, the worst bit about it, that hopelessness, loneliness, because you feel that, that's quite a hole to get out of. Honestly, man, the stories I have heard, there's always someone worse off than you.
Considering what you've told me about your story, that's a pretty incredible thing to say.
I love these guys, and that's what we show through the charities, that we love you all, and it's through love that we're going to drive out hate. But we've just got to do this together.
How will you know you've succeeded? At what point?
Oh, such a good question. One, a presumption of shared parenting at the point of separation, when it's safe to do so. Number two, when we're beginning to see employers change the way they treat fathers who are going through family breakdown and realizing it's a significant life moment and a stress event. When health visitors, midwives, this, that, and the other go and see mum after the birth of their baby and then go, oh, how's dad? Where is he? Can I talk to him? The police or social workers or whoever have more curiosity when they're faced with family breakdown, domestic issues. Just going, all right, let's have a reasonable conversation about this, and let's understand why you say what you say. When there's balance in the system, this, I think there's a long way to go. But that's when I know, when I will feel that things are being taken seriously. When there's better in the media, better representation of the fathers. What I'd love to see is either one of the big soaps that we have in this country run with a story of a father who's not seeing their children and he's done nothing wrong. I mean, that'd be fantastic to see that. When we see a story where there's a male victim of domestic abuse, when society catches up and realises that we've got many ills in society and we've got many ills that we need to tackle, but we do this with balance and fairness and equality and equity. That's when I think we've done it. But I don't know if we'll ever reach that.
I really hope you're as inspired by Nav's story as I am. What an incredible, incredible journey. Somebody who went to the depths of darkness in his own life, then to become a beacon of light to an entire community. The work they're doing is absolutely critical, essential. As you've heard, it actually saves lives and enhances the lives of others. If you do want to get in touch with Dads Unlimited, I'll leave their contact details in the show notes. If you do want to get in touch with me about any aspect of this series or this podcast, then contact me, divorcedmuslimdad@gmail.com, or hit me up on Instagram @MOIAZAM. I love hearing from you. I actually love hearing from you. It's so good to get feedback. As long as it's constructive, we're all good. Take care. See you next time. Assalamu alaikum.